Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives as usual. We start with the good, and Jim, depending on your perspective, this could be good for everybody or just darn horrible for everyone. Now, just a little bit earlier this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, made the ruling that Americans have the right to give the legal maximum to any candidate for Congress and president, as well as to parties and PACs, without worrying that they will violate the law. The Associated Press version says that there was a limit set at $123,200 for the 2013 and 2014 cycle. The Supreme Court saying that you do still have to honor individual contribution limits to specific candidates, parties, or PACs, but not a total limit to the different entities that you donate to. Clarence Thomas saying that he'd strike that down too. Very interesting to look at the different reactions here. Chief Justice Roberts saying that money in politics may seem repugnant to some, but so do does much of what the First Amendment vigorously protects. In my email inbox just a few minutes ago from a lefty organization, we got this title: Did the Supreme Court Just Undo Democracy? So, Jim, I'm guessing it's somewhere in the middle.
So when the decision first came down, the reaction on Twitter and amongst a lot of people I know was this, wow, you know, this gasp, this sense of believing that this was a enormous, game-changing alteration of the rules that is, you know, it's free for all, do whatever you want. You know, on an email thread that I'm on, someone featured an old Gary Larson Far Side cartoon in which some fishermen are fishing on a lake. Over in the distance, you see mushroom clouds. World War III has broken out. There's nuclear weapons being used. And one fisherman says to the other, I'll tell you what this means, Norm. No size restrictions and screw the limit. So on the one hand, you can see the consultant class like, oh my goodness, we've got unlimited donations. Sheldon Adelson can buy retirement homes for all of us. You know, the more I think about it, the more I think this is not actually going to have that big a real world impact. Because if you're an Adelson or a Tom Steyer on the left side, or you know, theoretically, I guess you could throw in the Koch brothers, you know, the limit was $123,000 per cycle, which is more than most of us will ever give to any candidate and all stuff. But that's gone. But these guys are already giving lots of money to groups like super PACs and groups that didn't have these sorts of limits. Bill Maher giving his $1 million contribution and stuff like that. So basically, this just takes off that limit, but they still have the $2,600 limit for candidates. So if you're an Adelson, if you're a super donor, you can spread it out more, but you can still only give it in $2,600 per candidate. That's good if you're a candidate, and apparently it takes off the limits to giving to the parties, so that basically you can give, I guess, like $74,000 to the National Political Committee of a political, you know, the RNC or the DNC or something. This might be really good news for the DNC or for the RNC. But in the end, this is, you know, like, there, first of all, there are only so many super donors in the country, and there are only so many places they can put their money. It's not like this court decision is going to come down and then Adelson's going to say, all right, now I'm really going to spend money after he spent like $60 million last night, or any of these guys. Like, they're already in it. They're already committed. And one of the lessons of campaign finance reform over the last couple of years is that the money will find a way to get there, whether it's the shadow campaigns of the recently not reelected D.C. mayor Vincent Gray, or these quote unquote independent groups that are very clearly designed to help, you know, a candidate or hurt a candidate. So I actually think this might be less of a big deal than people are reacting right now. But the more significant thing might be just a sense that the Supreme Court says, wait a minute, money is speech. That basically, if you try to limit how much money somebody can spend on promoting their cause or promoting what they believe in, you're fundamentally restricting their right to free speech. And you know, that's something that's probably good news for a lot of conservatives, because we've always kind of had this argument of like, wait a minute, why is government coming in and regulating political speech when that's precisely what the First Amendment is all about?
Well, on to the bad martini now. And we've talked about this at least one other time, but the latest round of Middle East peace efforts, as led by our esteemed Secretary of State John Kerry, appear to be hitting a bit of a snag. So one of the things that the U.S. is mulling over in order to jumpstart the process as a possible concession to the Israelis for other concessions on their part is the release of convicted spy Jonathan Pollard. He's been incarcerated now for passing along sensitive information from the U.S. To the Israelis back in the 1980s. Some say that what he did is bad, but not so bad that he should spend the rest of his life in prison. It's probably time to let him out. Others say absolutely not. And others just say this shows how fruitless and pointless and hopeless this latest diplomatic effort is in the Middle East. So, Jim, what are you thinking?
I have always thought this was a terrible, terrible idea to let Pollard go. And as a guy who generally thinks pretty warm and fuzzy thoughts about Israel, it's kind of interesting to find myself in disagreement with other pro-Israel voices on the right. My attitude is, look, Pollard sold us out. All right, he worked for the United States government. He was entrusted with classified information to the United States government. I don't care if you leak our information to Canada. I don't care if you leak it to the Brits. You know, you took an oath to protect that information. And you can't decide for yourself, well, my government's classified this, but I really think the Israelis need to know about this. So I'm going to defy my bosses and give it to them. I mean, they have, you know, venues to say, look, this is really important information. We need to share it with the Mossad or something like that. This was serious stuff. I've never quite liked the fact that to the Israelis and to a certain number of pro-Israel Americans, the release of Pollard has been this cause celeb, this you know, noble calling that they seem to think. Because, look, in the end, he betrayed this country. And as much as I like Israel, you know, my top priority is this country. And you can't just say, no big deal. You know, we like the country you leaked the information to. The idea that we are going to release him in order to get the Israelis to play nice at the negotiation table, I think the entire Mideast peace process is a fool's errand and naive wishful thinking to begin with. The idea that we have to make concessions in order to help there be peace between two other countries strikes me as particularly asinine. And I'm just kind of marveling at how John Kerry and Barack Obama are so desperately chasing this Nobel Peace Prize. Obama needs a second one to balance out the coffee table, I guess. That he's willing to have one, like, we're willing to, you know, forgive crimes and stuff like that. It's terrible. It's ridiculous. Yes, I know Pollard's been in jail for a long time, but you know what? You leak state secrets, you should be in jail for a long time. And I don't like the idea that he's turned into this diplomatic bargaining chip for the Israelis. You know, it says something that the one time Barack Obama wants to do something nice for Israel, he does the one thing that I think is even worse for us and our national interests, I'd argue.
On to the crazy martini now. And Jim, we've talked about it a couple different times in the last few days, and that's General Motors. At the time that they were taking our hard-earned taxpayer dollars as part of the bailout back in 2009 and beyond, they knew that there were faulty ignition switches, particularly on Chevy Cobalt. They decided not to do a recall for years and years, despite, I believe, a couple dozen deaths along the way. So the relatively new CEO of General Motors, Mary Barra, was testifying on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise referred to a particularly relevant document in this whole investigation. And let's just say Ms. Barra did not seem to have a firm grasp on what was happening.
This is the actual sheet that the engineer signed off on that approved the design change in the faulty ignition switch. Have you seen that document before?
This is the first time I've seen this document.
When you're preparing for testimony on a specific issue and why you didn't do a recall, that would seem pretty relevant to your prep, Jim.
Yeah, and this is a document that GM, their legal team, submitted to the House Committee on investigating this. So just kind of glaring. Some bad reviews for her testimony, others. But in other corners, what makes this a crazy martini is there is this real push in the media coverage of this to promote a narrative of old GM is bad, new GM is good, and Barra is the good person who's coming forward and coming clean and promising to make it right and all that stuff. And you could probably, well, why have we all of a sudden found a corporate executive that the media wants to be really nice to? Some might say because she's the first woman to head up a major automaker. I pointed out, completely unmentioned any of the coverage yesterday, Barra was the guest of First Lady Michelle Obama at this year's State of the Union address. Right there in the State of the Union address, President Obama didn't quite mention her by name, but referred to her saying, you know, our success should depend not on the accident of birth, but the strength of our work ethic and the scope of our dreams. It's how the daughter of a factory worker is CEO of America's largest automaker. And at that moment, all the cameras, you know, cut to her. Not to take away from anything Ms. Barra has done in her career, but she is now coming up and saying, look, I had no idea any of this stuff was going on. I just became CEO in January, and I'm going to help make it right. I'm not certain she's lying, but I'm just going to say it is surprising because it's not like they plucked her from the assembly line or something like that. She was vice president and, you know, various vice presidential positions from 2008 until the end of last year. So she's been at the highest levels of GM. She says she never saw that memo. She says she never learned about this need to recall these defective switches that can make the car have an accident until earlier this year. And I can't help but wonder, Greg, when she says earlier this year, you think it was before or after the State of the Union?
That was pretty early.
Sitting, being saluted by the president on national television, and in back of her mind, she might know, oh, by the way, we've got this major issue in which, you know, people are driving cars that are unsafe, and I hope none of them have accidents today. But then the next thing is, if, as she says, it's true that she had no idea, not only was she a vice president, her whole career has been in the engineering department, which is where all this discussion of the switches was going on. So not only is it like, oh, she didn't hear it because she was CEO, she didn't hear it in her own department, which seems a little more unusual. If I understand GM's explanation now, is that, yeah, a whole bunch of, you know, engineers noticed there was a problem with the switch. They substituted the switch. They kept the same part number, which is a big no-no and not something you're ever supposed to do. Nobody reported it up the line. Nobody acknowledged it. In other words, it's kind of like, you know, like with the IRS, low-level employees in Cincinnati did something really, really wrong and didn't tell anybody up the ladder because they want to protect the people up top. Is it possible that happened? Sure, but it just kind of seems a little surprising that all these low-level employees would be doing something very wrong, very illegal, very dangerous. And they're doing it, by the way, apparently to save roughly $1 per car in terms of cost of these switches. It never makes its way up the ladder because we know that as of May 2009, there was a fairly high-level meeting at GM in which they talked about the seriousness of this problem. Earlier today, Chuck Todd of MSNBC finally asked Claire McCaskill, hey, you know, we bailed out this company. And back in 2009, we gave them $49 billion and ultimately lost $10 billion on the deal. Does the government have some culpability here? McCaskill dismissed the question and said, oh, you know, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous to expect the government to know this when the CEO of GM didn't know this. Well, some people at GM knew. You know, some people at GM have known this for years and years and years and never told the public. So I think the government does have, you know, some serious questions to answer about how thorough their review was of GM at the time, since this clearly was a ticking time bomb in terms of liability issues in people's lives. And then the next question is, or was the whole objective of the president's auto industry task force, was its purpose just get money to the company as quick as possible and don't ask too many questions? So that is my rant. I expect we have not heard the last of this, but I would just tell listeners to keep their eyes open and their ears alert for this. Oh, Mary Barra is the one who's going to put all this right. And isn't she the noble hero in this sad, sordid story?
We'll be on top of it. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Thursday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great day, everyone.